This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Leslie Karst. She was here a little while ago, and we were talking about this wonderful book she wrote called Justice is Served, A Tale of Scallops, the Law, and Cooking for RBG. That's Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I love that book so much, and I was so happy to discover that she also writes the Sally Solari Mysteries. And so she's back today, and we're going to talk about book number 6, A Sense for Murder. Aha! I love it. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Patsy. It's great to be back in Florida again.
Oh, it's nice to talk to you. Well, I have to tell my listeners, oh, please, please make sure you have some cannoli in the house. Don't read this book if there's no... Where's the cannoli? You need the cannoli.
Don't read the books hungry is what I've been told.
Oh, you can't. Oh, it's terrible because you're in a real dilemma. Now, you're reading the book, and the description of the food is so good, and as I was down by the pool, and I can't get up and get dressed and go somewhere and get some of this stuff. So I just have to get fat reading the book. Your description of food, I mean, obviously, you are someone who loves food.
That's true. Yes, I cannot deny it.
And it comes through. So this is book number 6. Wow, mm-hmm. It's really great. And I will say, now, of course, I want to tell all my listeners that you are a retired lawyer.
Correct.
And it seems to me that where do lawyers go when they retire? They all go to the computer and start writing novels.
I believe that must be true, because there are an awful lot of us. For me, it made a little more sense, because I was actually a research and appellate attorney, so I actually wrote legal briefs. And so then when I retired from the law, I wanted to keep writing. But I tell you what, guess which was more fun to write? More fun to kill people on paper and write about the food that they eat.
Yeah, I think so. So this one, of course, it is... I never know how much to give away, but I will say one thing, that I am of the mind. I believe in the death penalty for anybody who steals a book. Because I have no sympathy for people who steal books. A book, when you have a book, it is something that nobody should ever take away from you. So there, it might come up in this book. I don't know how much we want to tell, but why don't you sort of lay the premise for this book?
I think it's okay to give that away, because it happens pretty early on. There's my protagonist, Sally Solari, ends up offering to cook at a benefit farm-to-table dinner in Santa Cruz, California, where the books are set. And it's a benefit, and one of the items that's up for auction is a signed copy of Mastering the Art of French Cooking by Julia Child. And I put that in there just because I love Julia Child so much. I wanted to put her in the book.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the inciting incidents is when somebody is murdered at the dinner, and the books, the signed books, the box set, are stolen. So, you know, you wonder...
Who would do that?
What have in common?
Diabolical person would do that. A terrible, really terrible.
Are
human
they even
being.
Related or not? You know, is it? Yeah.
It's just I was after that person right away. I'm going to get those books back, and that's what Sally does. What's so wonderful about this series? It's like when you start reading it and Sally is so good, her father's so good, and you start feeling like you're right there. You're with them, and it's just wonderful reading.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. And it's the first one you read the series, right?
Well, I read, yes, it was the first one I read of the series, and then I had to go back.
Well, that's good to know then, because, you know, people ask, do you have to read them in order? And I always say, no, you don't have to read them in order. I make it so you don't have to. If you want to, it's great. But so I'm glad to hear that you enjoyed it, even though you read them out of order. So, hey, you can, listeners out there, you can dip in anywhere.
Oh, yeah, you can start, and you can go back, and because once you read one, you'll want to read the rest, because I had so much fun. I love Death al Fresco.
Oh, good.
And you must have so much fun thinking up new names for them.
I do. Coming up for the names for the books are very fun, because each one I want to have, it has to have something about food in it, but also murder, and so yeah, it's good fun.
Well, you've created a. Tell us a little bit about Sally and her restaurant, which I, you know, unfortunately, I live in such a beautiful area, but we are not a food area. We don't have like in Toronto where you have, you know, so many restaurants and that you can go to, or obviously in the West Coast there are so many places, and we actually are an ideal place. We should have Restaurant Row, but we don't really.
Yeah. Interesting. You must have a lot of cooks then. People cook for them.
Maybe, because even in Detroit we have wonderful streets of restaurants, so it's really difficult to find. And this one, the idea of a Polynesian with a Polynesian flair, I like that.
Yeah. So the restaurant that Sally's family, she grew up in her family restaurant called Solari's, which is an Italian seafood restaurant out on the municipal fishing wharf in Santa Cruz. But then in the book one, chapter one, her aunt owns this restaurant called Gauguin, which is named after the French painter who moved to Polynesia. And it's a more upscale, trendy French Polynesian place that she ends up inheriting. And then so throughout the six books, there's sort of a dynamic between her father and her, because it's sort of setting apart the old school Italian fishermen that had emigrated to Santa Cruz back in the 1880s and through the 1910s, and she's a fourth generation Italian. And then the new hipster foodies that have moved in Santa Cruz in the last few decades, and it's based on reality, and there's this dynamic between the old and the new. And her father starts thinking, you know, you don't think, you know, you think you're better than us now, you know, and they love each other, but that's sort of the setup. And so Gauguin is a French Polynesian restaurant, and it's really fun coming up with the recipes and the menu items for both the Italian seafood place and the modern place. Let me spread my wings.
Well, luckily you put some recipes at the back, so people can, if they don't have a restaurant near them, they can get out there into the kitchen.
Right.
which is also a lot of fun. So, yeah, that's great. I love the recipes in the back. I haven't been up to cooking lately, and I'm sort of trying to find restaurants. I don't really have a place here that has great cannolis, which is funny.
Yeah.
You would think that we
And
would,
they're hard to make.
Yeah. You have to know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you make
them? Yeah, and a good one. No, I'm not much of a baker. It's too, for baking you have to, it's like they're like, they call them formulae. They don't even call them recipes, the real bakers. You have to, they're exacting. You have to measure and weigh things and cook at exact times. And I'm a seat-of-the-pants cook that throws things in and tastes it and adds a little more of this and that. And so it's not my, I mean, I can bake. When I did go to cooking school and I had to learn to do it, but it's not my favorite thing. So, no, never made cannolis. But I sure like to eat.
Oh, that's for sure. And you make them sound so good, mouth-watering. So I'm in search lately. I've been looking for. I decided at one. I think during the pandemic, partly, I was really going back to basics. Since we couldn't go out anywhere, I did actually do quite a bit of baking, because I wanted real, you know, fresh stuff.
Right.
And it's such a difference. I mean, really now. I couldn't eat processed bakery or processed bread for anything. I just couldn't do it.
It's true, boy. If you don't have actually a really good bakery near you, and if you're just buying supermarket bread, the difference between a freshly baked baguette or sourdough loaf is And many people did. I have a lot of friends who started baking sourdough loaves during the pandemic and still do. And it's good to have them as friends because sometimes they drop it by your house.
Yeah. that's what all of my friends say. Oh, what are you baking? I do specialize in biscotti, by the way. I love biscotti.
Yum.
And I make the best biscotti. I can do it really. And the funny thing is, I actually don't need a recipe. I look at it, and I have this feel for biscotti. Where I don't know where I got it from because we're not it's not part of our tradition. But there's something about biscotti, and I make it so it's people go crazy for my biscotti. So people keep saying I should make, you know, start a chain, but that's a whole problem. Then I don't want anything artificial in it. I just like
right,
it.
Right.
It's really so few ingredients, and you just
just add coffee.
I think you know, and that's one of the things when people are reading about your recipes, when the food that you talk about, it is really so true. So much of it is really simple. Just good ingredients. And I like the idea of this farm-to-table organization.
Did right. You? Yeah, no. In Santa Cruz, where the books are set, is a the town of Santa Cruz is, you know, there aren't farms right in town, but all around it are north between Santa Cruz and San Francisco. You drive up Highway 1, you go through Brussels sprout and strawberry farms and berry farms, and then south of the community is the Salinas Valley, which is breadbasket of California, and so we are blessed with so much amazing food, fresh food, vegetables, and wine, and farmstead cheeses, and pastured pigs, and yeah, I'm very lucky to live where I do, as is my character Sally, and she appreciates it.
So now, of course, in this book also you added sort of I like the idea of the teenagers learning to cook and learning to share their food.
Right, yeah, the benefit is to benefit this organization called Teens Table, which I made up, but there are organizations like that in Santa Cruz where the kids come into an industrial kitchen and they cook, they learn to cook, so that's that skill, but then the food is donated to worthy organizations like the senior center or the homeless projects and things, and so that's the benefit that Sally's cooking for.
Yeah, and I think, well, I don't know if it's widespread, if they have the really places like that. I haven't heard of anything around here, but I got so excited about the idea that I was thinking, how could I put that together? I want to do that. I want to do that for teenagers. I'd love it because, as I said, I'm a great baker, I would just love to teach young people how to do that. And then
you've got a second career.
So
because it does. Something like that, a couple of them do exist here in Santa Cruz. So I think it's you should need to start one.
Yeah, you know, I think I've been inspired to do that because it would be fun. I would love it. For example, I could do my biscotti if I taught the kids how to do my biscotti and they gave it away. Well, everybody would be so happy.
They would be. That's terrific.
So you have so much fun writing about the food. Isn't it wonderful when you find this joy that I talk about, the joy of writing, that it just makes your life so full?
No, it is true. And having done different styles of writing, to get to write these novels now, which are not that different, you know, some people have asked me, you know, gosh, it must be so different from writing the legal briefs. And yes, of course it is, but it's a lot more fun, and you get to make things up. But there's a lot in common, too, because, you know, when you write a legal brief, you're trying to convince the judge to rule in your favor in whatever case is before the court. And you have a specific set of facts, right? And then you have to research the case law that backs up the facts. But how you put that together in your brief makes a big difference. How do you organize your facts? Which ones do you emphasize? You can't leave them out. That's not playing fair. Same thing with a mystery novel. You've got to put in red herrings and clues, but you got to play fair with the reader. You can't leave things out and bring them in at the last second. How do you organize it? How do you tell your story? How do you, convince the audience that this person did it when really there's this person and you hit a clue about them? And so they're actually, my brain worked well for both of those. It's an organizational thing. And so In retrospect, it seems kind of like a natural progression to go to start writing murder mysteries after writing legal briefs.
That's it. You have to convince a judge to sort of follow along and get the right clues in her head. So when she makes the final decision, she's got all that in there, and it's just the same way with the reader. We reading along, and while we're salivating over the recipes, we're picking up other clues here.
Exactly. Well, yes. While you're thinking about how hungry you are, I've slipped a really important clue in there that you might have missed.
Yeah. And now, tell me, do you have a Thunderbird?
I do not have a T-Bird.
Oh.
I gave Sally a 57 T-Bird because I always wanted one, and they're a pain. Apparently, they break down a lot, and there are not many people that work on them, and I don't work on cars, and so I've been told, really, you shouldn't get one unless you either are or live with a mechanic. So I decided to give one to Sally instead. So I feel like I kind of have one.
Yeah.
I get to research them. But that's the fun thing about writing, is you get to give your character all the things. You know, I made her tall and slender, and she can eat as much as she wants without getting fat. And I gave her all the things that I wish I had.
Oh, yeah, that's nice. Yeah, she eats a lot. She tastes everything. And, yeah, she doesn't weigh 300 pounds because you couldn't fit into the Thunderbird.
Right, exactly.
And it's not actually a very comfortable car. You know,
yeah, that's true. But and I did have a car with bucket seats. I had a 63 Ford Falcon convertible back in the 90s, and I loved that car. But then the bucket seats, though, were fun when I was young. But yes, getting in and out of them as you get older is probably not that fun.
Oh, no, it's not. It was terrible. I made a guy feel so bad. He took me, he had a Jaguar, and you get into a Jaguar and you're so low to the ground, it's terrifying, because the 18 wheel is taller than the stupid Jaguar. And when I got out of the Jaguar and I climbed out, and I was young, and I climbed out of it, and it was so uncomfortable, I said, "Oh, this is such an uncomfortable car." And he just, you know, everything is his face.
No, it's true. A lot of those sports cars are like that. Yeah, you're so low and you can't see.
No.
I mean,
you can see.
You can't see to drive.
You can see underneath the 18-wheeler. I don't want to see the bottom side of the underwheeler. So, yeah, I hurt that guy's feelings. All of that money he invested in that to impress me didn't work. So, but it is fun, and that's one of the things. And of course, we have, of course, I love a little bit of Italian thrown in.
Mm-hmm.
So that always makes it a lot of fun.
Right. Yep. I did study Italian. People ask me if I'm Italian, and I'm actually not. I wish I were, but you know, I had my DNA done, and nope, no Italian, unfortunately. But she's Sally's fourth generation, and I did study the language. So there's a little, there's not much, but
not
there's
not
a little
much. Just a
sort of local Italian American thrown in there, and it's fun, and it really is based on Santa Cruz is full of it. You know, the Italian families are so influential, particularly about food around here, and I know tons of Italians, and so people tell me that it's an accurate rendition of the family.
Yeah, it reads well. It reads well, and I love your use of words. You use words that aren't used that often. I came across what was it, a word that gave me put a smile on my face. Oh, skedaddle. I like
skedaddle.
I think it's great. It's a nice word. I enjoy
it. My mom used to say that, skedaddle.
Yeah,
and I'm not sure where she got it.
I don't know. I think my mom must have, too, because as I'm reading and I got to that, and I sort of, skedaddle! That's a great, isn't that a great word?
Yeah, it is a fun, it's one of those words that kind of sounds like what it is.
Exactly. So you're just having fun, and I'm really thrilled about the series, and I want people to make sure they go and get it. And this one is called A Sense for Murder. And thank you for the lovely bookmarks that you sent me.
You're very welcome. Yes, the bookmarks have recipes on them.
I was going to say that, yes. And the grilled peaches with balsamic vinegar, plum sauce. Now, that is a great recipe.
Yep.
That is
yes.
a really
and
great
to all the listeners, if you go on my website, Leslie Karst, K-A-R-S-T, author.com, and you send me an email with your address, I will mail you some of those bookmarks with my recipes on them, if you like.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, I will make sure I mention that to people, because that is wonderful. I love that. And the thing is, they're nice, solid bookmarks. They're, you know, heavy weight, and they're really great.
Mm-hmm.
I've been using them in the other books I'm reading, and I'm thinking, I need to start cooking. So you linger in the mind, which is nice.
That's good. As long as it's a good taste.
It is. And everybody, I want to tell you, this is a wonderful book. You can binge read it. It's still summertime. All the people seem to want to get over summertime. Like, they're already talking about the fall, but it's summertime.
I know.
It's hot. And yes. This is a time to just cool down.
I agree. Sit outside by the pool and read. And they're available both as e-books and as hard copy books.
Yeah, and it's just so much fun just to binge out and just have a good time, and then check out your local restaurants and find out who's got the best cannoli. Again, Leslie Karst, I think your writing is terrific. And anybody who's interested in Ruth Bader Ginsburg, they must get Justice is Served, because it's so filled with information about RBG, and it's a wonderful, wonderful book, and people will love it.
Okay, well, thanks. I appreciate the plug for that book, because that one's dear to my heart since it's a memoir.
Yeah,
I really did cook for her. And I'm stressed and obsessed about it, the dinner.
and as we're reading it, we're stressing too. We want it all to go well. And it did. And I'm sure it was just wonderful. I think famous people really appreciate when somebody does something very personal for them.
I agree. And, you know, even me, I'm not famous by any means, but people know that I like to cook, and so people rarely cook for me. And it's like, hey, I love food. I'll eat anything. I'll eat make me just a scrambled egg. I don't care. I think you're right. I think, and she did. Ruth did appreciate it. She had a good time.
Okay, well, this is book number 6 in the Sally Solari Mystery Series, and it's called A Scent for Murder. It's available online and hopefully wherever books are sold. And you can visit Leslie's website and send her a message, and she'll send you these lovely bookmarks with a recipe. Thank you so much for joining me, Leslie. I'm sure you're working.
You
finished book 7 already?
No. Working on a new series that's coming out in spring that's set in Hawaii, where I live half time.
I like that you write Hawaii with the apostrophe. I like that.
Well, yes, that's the way they do it there. So.
that's the proper way to do it. I love it. Okay, well then I'll look forward to having you back in the springtime. Okay,
that would be terrific. Thank you so much, Patsy, for having me on. I love talking to you. You're a blast.
And you're a joy. Bye-bye now.
Thank you. All righty. Bye-bye.
Okay. We're going to have a book buzz from Rita Moreau, and who was actually, she sent me a lovely picture. Rita, hello. I hope you're having fun up north. And then we'll have some commercials, and I'll be back with my next guest.
Fellow mystery lovers, this is author Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with a mystery that will keep you turning the pages. Carol J. Perry's Now You See It. Sometimes 13 is a lucky number, and for fans of Carol J. Perry's Witch City Mystery Series, it is, with this latest installment that features Lee Barrett, the program director for Salem, Massachusetts, local station WICH-TV, In Now You See It, Lee and her husband, Detective Sergeant Pete Mondello, are settling into their new home. The honeymoon is over, and Lee is back on the job as program director for Salem's WICH-TV, recently promoted to historical documentary chief executive. Her first project is to promote Salem's new international museum. Seems easy enough. She loves looking at their collection and doing research about Salem's long-ago days as a shipping capital. That is until the driver of a truckload of antiquities turns up dead. Soon, Lee and Pete are dredging up clues along with a hearty crew of helpers. Aunt Ibby, a former librarian, offers her advice, while a local practicing witch, River North, has some ideas too. And of course, Orion, Lee's clairvoyant cat, has his own ideas. But when a ship model in the exhibit's collection appears to be haunted, Lee will have to dive into her own treasure trove of psychic gifts. For author Carol J. Perry, juggling details and coming out with twisty plots is her specialty. After all, she was born on Halloween Eve in Salem. Special thanks to Kensington Publishing for another great cozy mystery. Pre-order Now You See It by Carol J. Perry and expect the unexpected in a mystery that features a memorable cast of characters and lots of page-turning fun. This book will be released on September 26, 2023. Now You See It, book number 13 in Carol J. Perry's Witch City Mystery Series, is available online. This is Rita Moreau, author of the Ghost and Camper Cookie Mystery Series, reporting for Joy on Paper. For more of my suggestions, go to our website, www.radio-joyonpaper.com. Buzzing off for now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest, Lisa Black. And the name of her book is What Harms You? Oh, this is an exciting book. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
Wow. Oh, I love this book. I love this book. Oh, I love this book.
Well, thank you.
Well, I love this new series, the Low Card Institute Thrillers, are so good. We're here for the first book. I said, oh, this is great, this is great. And now this one, I mean, you've outdone yourself. New York Times bestselling author, and you deserve it because this one is so, it's just so good.
Well, I'd love to hear that.
Well, you know, you have, you're doing for forensic writing what Abby Sciuto did for forensics on TV. You make it come alive.
Good. Good. I hope a little slightly more realistically than TV.
Yeah, well, she has to do everything in 55 minutes.
An hour. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, yes, she, with commercials,
I get
too.
That. Yeah, really. So it's more like 35 minutes.
Yeah. So, you know, she does pretty well, but, and she does it all herself, too, by the way. She doesn't have this whole institute that you've got here working.
Mm-hmm.
So, tell us about the Low Carb Institute. It's, the concept is wonderful, and this new story, well, I got such a kick out of it because it's suspenseful. There are a lot of different minor storylines that go throughout it, little mysteries too. So tell us about this new book and about the whole setting for the book.
Well, I came up with a low card as it's like one third research. They have a whole score of professors and scientists there who work in every field of, you know, forensics, from fingerprints to digital analysis to, you know, paint and glass and DNA, everything, and question documents. So they, like, one third of the institute is devoted to research, one third is devoted to training, mostly law enforcement professionals and other scientists. And then one third will be private cases so that Ellie and Rachel can be basically traveling around the country at, you know, to these high profile situations and, you know, where they're investigating on behalf of a private client. And which in the first book in Red Flag, that's why Rachel is there, because she's hired by the father. So in this book, it's entirely set at the Low Carb Institute around their training classes, because I've been in forensics for going on 35 years now, and I've had like over 1,200 hours of continuing education, which, you know, in forensics is where you learn all the specialty kind of fields where you don't get in college, even if you have a forensic science degree, and you get more, you know, hands-on practice with it, etc. So this is a very common thing in my field. So I thought, you know, it just popped into my head, what happens if a serial killer goes to CSI school, you know, obviously with the purpose of learning everything he shouldn't do and needs to avoid if he wants to keep not getting caught. So once there, he simply can't resist, he or she simply can't resist, you know, committing murders right under the noses of the people who are considered the best in the country at catching, you know, people like them.
An egotist wants to get away with the perfect crime.
Yes, well, most serial killers are.
So now, Dr. Ellie Carr, the book starts, it's her first day on the job. And she's got a lot of things happening in her life, including a new house.
Yeah. She was recently divorced and, you know, divorced from the man who runs the lab where she used to work for the FBI. So she was kind of happy to get away from that, even though they're on amicable terms. And so she was so thrilled about coming to the Low Carb Institute, which is just internationally renowned. And I just love this idea of, you know, her coming in on her first day in the job, and she's so excited, you know, and, you know, trying not to show it. Of course, she's being a professional. She's got to take over a class for a professor who's going to be leaving to present this new concept of tracing serial killers. And that predecessor winds up, you know, just a few hours later, dead in a supply closet in what looks like it could be an accident. It should be an accident. It's just an accident. But Rachel and Ellie just can't quite see that. You know, they're like, yeah, but... And so that kind of starts things off.
Well, it better not be an accident, because then the book would have been too short. So it's just the right length. It keeps us turning the pages. It's very exciting. The writing is terrific. Of course, you wrote a previous series, and your writing is well known, to be terrific. And in this one, you pull out all
Thank
the
you.
Stops, I think. And your background, of course, is, as you said, in forensics. Now, mm-hmm. you've appeared in court a number of times, right?
Oh, yes, that's part of the job.
Your specialty was what?
It's the worst part of the job. Well, at the coroner's office in Cleveland, I did Harrison Fibers, paint and glass, gunshot residue, clothing examination. But here in Cape Coral, for the past 23 years, I mostly do fingerprints. I'm a certified latent print examiner. And then we all do, crime scene work, processing evidence, going to crime scenes, photographing, documenting, measuring, collecting the evidence, etc.
And you don't like going to court?
Yeah, court is like the worst part of the job, because you have no control over it. You have to be there when they tell you to be there. You have to stay there as long as they tell you to stay there. You're on the stand. You have no control over what they ask you or how they ask you. And, sometimes it'll be no further questions, and sometimes it'll be, an hour or two of these obscure things, and you just never know. And as I said, you have no control over any of it.
A lot of waiting around.
Yes. There's a lot of waiting, you're not in sitting in court watching everybody else testify. So it's not even interesting. You're in a tiny little windowless room, and the only saving grace is now the courthouse has free Wi-Fi. So that makes things a little bit better.
So you can do some surfing while you're waiting to testify.
Yeah, you can get some work done. Yeah, I've take my iPad and get my writing done. But with COVID, it stopped entirely, and they haven't really gotten quite back up to speed yet. No, I haven't had to do that a lot lately.
So it's so much fun. Doing research is so much fun in general, and then that is your bailiwick. You are great at it in real life, and it makes it so much fun that you can use all this knowledge in your books.
Yes, it's handy, kind of, because it's got a dual purpose. It's like anything I learn, I can use on the job, and I can use in the book as well. So, yeah. Sometimes I'll go, like at work, they had a deception detection, like how to tell when somebody's lying, for the police officers. It was part of, continuing ed that they like routinely have. And I contacted and said, can I go to this? It's like, I don't need a certificate or anything like that. I don't need a count for anything. I just like to take the class. And they said, well, yeah, if there's room, if they've got a space, you can take it. So I did. So I went for like 2 days and, got the course on how to tell what somebody's lying to you.
Oh,
and a book that went with it. So I do refer back to that quite often.
Okay. Well, on NCIS, it's always that if you look left, then you're lying. So
yeah, that's not really true.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like theoretically true, but I always say, what if something moved to his left or something and caught his eye, or what if he just, realized, oh, there's a window there, like squirrel.
And then I always wondered,
that sort of thing.
I always wondered if it was different for left-handed people, like would only right-handed people would look left if they're lying,
yeah.
Or would left-handed people look right when they're lying? So, since I'm left-handed, I've been curious about that.
That's why, just like a physical lie detector, they always ask them a ton of questions first, just little innocuous, what's your name, where do you live, that kind of thing, just to get like a baseline of how they behave. Because if they're a very hyperactive person normally, then they're going to have all these sorts of movements in which, you know, somebody else who isn't like that, tends to be a more relaxed person, isn't going to do unless they're under some kind of stress.
Well, now, of course, you obviously you're a great writer. What writers influenced you?
I would say like Alistair MacLean. Really, I always go back to, because I mean, I not only read everything he wrote, I have a copy of everything he wrote. And I think he learned, I mean, I think I learned a lot about characterization from him, because his characters are, they don't do a lot of internal thought. I mean, it's what I call navel gazing. You don't go, he doesn't go on for paragraphs and paragraphs about what they're thinking. It's like you focus more on what they're doing. And that's kind of how I write, I think. You know, my characters are always doing something. There's some immediate purpose that they're trying to fulfill. And along the way, you get to know how they think and how they feel, but it's through that means. And P.D. James, I love P.D. James, and Jeffrey Deaver and Lisa Gardner. I think I learned a lot about plotting and pacing from Lisa Gardner.
Well, she's great. Yeah, she's been on the program. Same with Jeffrey. I love them, and you're right. The writing is it's so good that you do, when you finish reading their books, there's something that sort of gets in you, this joy that they have found in writing. Now, have you ever made a pilgrimage to an author's house or birthplace?
No. No, I have not.
No?
No, I don't know where any of them live, actually. I mean, I probably would for Alistair MacLean or P.D. James, but they live in England, and that'd be a little difficult to get to. Even though I have been to England, but that wasn't on the schedule.
Well, you can always go back and do that. You can go you can go to Agatha Christie's house.
Oh, that would be pretty cool.
Yeah. There are nice literary tours, actually, of England. So you can go around to all the places where famous authors have been and lived, and it's lots of fun. I actually moved to England because of Jane Austen. I wanted to live near where she was born. So that was sort of a big pilgrimage. I just picked up and I moved to England and bought a 400-year-old
that's
cottage.
That's dedication.
Yeah, that's dedication. Of course, here in Florida, everybody's... Well, you can always tell when it's going to be the time for Hemingway's birthday, because all the guys around here start having growing beards. They go down to the the Keys.
Key West?
Yeah, for the contest. So... So that's a pilgrimage you can make. One of the things, of course, for you, you have a full time job. So promotion wise, do you do events? Do you go like to BoucherCon and things like that to promote your books?
I'm not going to BoucherCon this year. I went to Writers for New Orleans, and I went to Sleuthfest over in Deerfield Beach. But I have been to BoucherCon in the past, and I'm planning to go next year. So, yeah, conventions are great. But, you know, like you said, I do still have the day job, so there's a limit to how much I can do.
I wish they'd have another BoucherCon here in Florida. I'm not up to traveling anymore. After the pandemic, I don't enjoy traveling anymore. So, people are crazy on airplanes, and you always get a feeling that there's going to be a crime right on the airplane, and then we need a forensic person in there to gather evidence. So, you know, I was a medical technician when I was young, and I liked the idea of forensics, but I didn't like blood and guts.
especially if they're mixed up, you know. So yeah, so I think it takes a very special person to do it. But you obviously enjoy your work, and now you with the new book. Also, I think you're enjoying some. Getting into the basics of refurbishing a house.
I'm kind of a HGTV addict, and I don't actually watch it, but if I'm anywhere where it's on, then I'm like glued to it, and I turn it on when I go down. We have a gym in the police department, so just during the day, because I work 12-hour shifts, so I'll go down and get on the treadmill for, you know, just 10 minutes to stretch my legs, and I'll always put on HGTV. But also, my husband and I have some land in Tennessee that we're planning to build on in the next year or two, so now I'm really thinking about houses and, you know, decorations and renovations and things like that.
Well, I have a feeling Dr. Ellie Carr is going to have fun with this, and with the third book is already written, or you're in the middle?
No, it's already written. It will be out next March, I believe, and it's called The Deepest Kill.
Okay, well, you're having lots of fun with that, and of course her colleague is Dr. Barbara Wright. And this is also...
Barbara Wright is the one that...
Dr. Rachel Davies. And Dr. Yes. Rachel Davies also is... You've got a nice dynamic between the two of them.
Yes, yeah. Rachel is very interesting. She's very, very, like, calmer, I guess. Compared to Ellie's life has been kind of crazy with, you know, being an orphan and raised with different relatives, even though they were all wonderful, but it was still a little up in the air always. And, you know, Rachel has had a very stable upbringing, and she lives with her widowed mother because they are raising her late sister's toddler, who she's absolutely crazy about. So, you know, Rachel is very, very grounded, but, you know, of course she... the assistant dean of the Locard, which she's given her like her life, 10 years of her life to this institution. So she, you know, feels very strongly about it. And so, but now she's torn between wanting to be home with, you know, the toddler and just all the usual pressures, you know, of especially being female and, you know, being having a career as well.
Well, I just want to tell my listeners they'll enjoy this book, and you can read this book, and then you can go back and read book one. But the new book is called What Harms You? It's suspenseful. It's filled with lots of information. I think people always like to, when they come away from a book, I think it's always enjoyable to know something new, and they will know something new from the way you present the forensic information. I love it. It's fascinating. Again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's Lisa Black's What Harms You, and your website is just Lisa Black. Is it just Lisa Black?
Lisa-Black.com.
I knew there was something about it. Lisa-Black. Yeah, okay. Lisa-Black. people can go to your website and find out more about you and your other books. And again, I will see you back here in March, okay?
Fabulous. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you so much for joining me today. Lisa Black, What Harms You? And a special thanks to Kensington, because I always love to invite Kensington authors to be on Joy on Paper, because you're a joy.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye.
All right. That is... It's a good book. Oh, I love this forensics. I love it. Really great. And wonderful storyline. Wonderful story. Great mystery. And it is available online, and you can get that. A special thanks again to Kensington for that book, and for all the other authors they've been sending me. I just got a whole bunch of new books from Kensington. Lots of wonderful books, including, of course, Carol J. Perry. Now You See It, and so make sure you get that, too.
And the following week, Bill Larson is going to be on, and I was very thrilled to get so many messages from you with questions for Bill Larson, our legal eagle, talking about intellectual property. I know everybody's really worried about it, and I'm getting more and more questions about whether or not I like covers that are made with AI, and whether or not I will interview authors whose covers are made with AI, and the whole question of what is going to happen with the big five if they're going to start using covers made with AI. I hope not, because it will put a lot of wonderful, wonderful illustrators out of business. Companies like Kensington, Kensington must have the greatest bunch of illustrators. Wherever they have them, wherever they get them from, their illustrators are always spot on with their covers. And I'm hoping that, I don't know if we have any industry standards anymore. I don't know if we have any standards anywhere, but I personally hope that we don't get a lot of AI covers, because I think it's so important. There are we have so many talented artists, and they really, really need the money. You know, authors, people always think, oh, are the authors making money? It's hard, you know, in this world nowadays to make money. There's so many things that you have to do, because an author doesn't just get the money. You know, they make the money, but they still have to do all of this social media, all of the web pages, all of this stuff, which costs also a lot of money. So I don't want them to lose any money, and I don't want the illustrators to lose any money. So I hope that if I know that some of the industry people are listening to me today, because they do, and that's how they know that I'm doing really great interviews with so many wonderful authors, and I appreciate it. And it's just my little hint to you all. I'm going to be looking carefully at whether or not I will interview people who do AI covers, because I hate the idea of putting artists out of work. I'm an artist on the side myself, and I don't want AI doing my paintings, and I don't want them working on book covers either. So it's something that we all have to think about, and it's like one more thing we need to think about. And you know what? Don't think about anything except find a good book to read this weekend. This week. It's still summertime. I keep feeling like people are pushing me into the fall. Anyway, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't know unless you try. So start writing, and just like Carol J. Perry is writing 1,000 words a day, she doesn't stop. She's like a little dynamo. You should do it too. Get busy and start writing, and say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. He saluted me. I saluted him. And I should have been a general. And boy, oh boy, I would be kicking some tushy today. Everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful day. Bye-bye now. We'll be right back.